Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive, where we take a stack of fascinating sources and distill the most important knowledge and insights, all custom-tailored for you. I'm Pat Livingston.
And I'm Chris Sinclair. Our mission today is to embark on a comprehensive and exhaustive deep dive into the pages of Bloomberg Businessweek for September 2025.
That's right.
We're going to dissect every article and topic, exploring not just what's happening, but the profound impacts and implications for our world. Get ready for a shortcut to being truly well-informed.
Okay, let's unpack this wealth of information from Bloomberg Businessweek's September issue. We're covering everything from global economics and geopolitical shifts to consumer trends, real estate, and even the future of work and culture.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to give you a crystal clear understanding of the forces shaping our present and future, offering those aha moments without the information overload.
Let's dive in.
Kicking us off in our economic currents, we really need to talk about the pervasive reach of tariffs, the initial 10% duty, and that very intense, albeit short-lived, 125% rate on China under Donald Trump. They're no longer theoretical.
No, not at all. These Liberation Day tariffs are now significantly impacting consumer goods.
Yeah.
And that's largely because the pre-tariff inventories that kind of buffered their effects are finally exhausted.
Right, that buffer's gone.
Exactly. So we're expecting to see these higher customs duties really show up in the July and August data.
And what's becoming clear here is the regressive nature of these tariffs, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially acting as a hidden tax on the very consumers the administration claims to protect.
That's a really good way to put it. I mean, consider the direct impact on college students and their parents this back-to-college season. Items like microwaves, table fans, bedding, plastic school supplies.
All the essentials.
Yeah, pencil cases, three-ring binders. They're seeing double-digit tariff increases. For example, over 90% of imported thermoses, table fans, and microwaves come from China and have been subject to these hikes.
I am 90%.
It's huge. Metal household furniture tariffs are up 20 percentage points. And if you're buying polyester or nylon bedding, again, over 90% from China, you're looking at a 27 percentage point increase.
That's massive compared to cotton.
Right. Starkly contrasting with just a 3-point rise for cotton. So this inevitably means higher college bills, easily running into four figures for many families.
And beyond that.
Well, we're already observing lower income households turning to used or refurbished goods just to try and circumvent these new tariffs, which, you know, just underscores how these policies disproportionately affect vulnerable populations.
And this certainly debunks the administration's original claim, doesn't it? That foreign companies would somehow bear the brunt.
Absolutely. It's U.S. companies and ultimately you, the consumer, who are absorbing these costs. That initial period where companies panic imported goods before the tariffs kicked in, that just delayed the visible impact.
And that buffer, as we said, is entirely gone now.
Completely gone. General Motors, for instance, reported a substantial $1.1 billion decline in quarterly profit directly attributed to tariffs. They made a strategic decision to absorb those costs rather than passing them on to car buyers.
Which is interesting, strategically.
It is. And if we look back at the 2017 tariffs, research indicated it took almost 6 months for price increases to really manifest, with companies still shouldering some of the burden 1.5 years later.
So it takes time to filter through.
Exactly. But this time, we're already seeing average price increases of 3% across household goods, furniture, and electronics due to Trump's tariffs. And that directly translates to higher prices for you, eroding your purchasing power, making everyday items more expensive.
So how does this fit into the broader economic strategy, particularly Treasury Secretary Bessent's approach? He initially seemed to believe this tariff gun would be loaded but seldom fired.
Right. That seemed to be the thinking. In fact, on Liberation Day, April 2nd, he even proposed an immediate tariff pullback to try and defuse the brewing crisis. But Trump, it seems, wanted to use them as, well, a scare tactic against trading partners.
That dynamic between Bessent and Trump is really revealing.
It truly is. Trump famously paused reciprocal tariffs for 90 days and set that 10% interim rate for most countries, excluding China, just hours before they were scheduled to activate.
Right down to the wire.
Totally. And while Bessent publicly praised Trump's courage, he privately acknowledged the reality. He said, quote, "The market did not force him. He has a higher risk tolerance than I do."
Mm.
Bessent appears to see his role as maybe a pragmatic funnel, channeling Trump's populist impulses into concrete policies and then deftly managing the narrative for the financial markets.
And he's been key in those trade talks.
Absolutely pivotal, securing bilateral pacts with key nations like Japan, Indonesia, Singapore, and South Korea. And these have led to some novel provisions, including those multi-billion dollar funds for U.S. investment, $550 billion from Japan, $350 billion from South Korea, for example, often alongside a 15% across-the-board tariff on their exports, mind you.
It's a complex, almost improvisational dance. And with China, tensions flared significantly after Beijing retaliated post-Liberation Day.
Oh, absolutely. A tentative truce was eventually struck, where U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods dropped to 30% from that staggering 145%.
145%. Just incredible.
And China's levy on U.S. goods reduced to 10% from 125%. This truce was extended for 90 days on August 11th, but there's a significant sticking point still remaining.
Which is?
China refuses to lift export controls on crucial rare earth metals until the U.S. eases its semiconductor restrictions, specifically allowing NVIDIA H20 chips back into their market.
So a high-stakes negotiation continues.
Very much so. And the implications of these ongoing trade negotiations are really far-reaching for everyone. From the immediate cost of your next appliance to the availability of critical tech components, these policies are directly shaping global supply chains and influencing prices.
So the long-term economic trajectory for the U.S. is still very much up in the air.
Highly uncertain. Whether we're looking at a period of stagflation or, as some optimists suggest, maybe a new golden age, it's just too early to tell. This really makes Bessent's careful navigation of this volatile landscape particularly critical for the stability of global commerce.
Okay, and now, shifting to something that hits even closer to home for many, let's delve into the deepening housing market crisis. Home ownership, long considered, you know, a fundamental pillar of the American dream, is becoming increasingly out of reach.
It really is, for more and more people at record rates. We're facing this compounding storm of costs driven by a severe lack of new construction since the 2008 financial crisis.
Still feeling those effects.
Definitely. Then you have homeowners understandably reluctant to give up their low-rate mortgages, the so-called golden handcuffs. And on top of that, escalating expenses stemming from climate change disasters are adding to the burden.
The data really paints a pretty stark picture, doesn't it?
It does. The annual income needed to afford a median-priced U.S. home has surged a staggering 60%. It jumped from about $79,000 in 2021 to nearly $127,000 in 2024.
60%. While incomes
barely moved.
Yes.
In sharp contrast, the median household income only crept up a mere 1.3% to just over $80,000 in 2023. We're also seeing property tax bills in regions like Florida, Dallas, and Las Vegas skyrocket by 32 to 50% between 2019 and 2024.
And there are other factors contributing to this perfect storm.
Oh, yes. Trump's tariffs are making essential building materials more expensive. And furthermore, immigration and customs enforcement, IC raids, are terrorizing immigrant construction workers.
Who make up a huge part of that workforce.
A significant majority of plasterers, drywall installers, roofers, painters. This creates substantial labor shortages, further driving up overall construction costs and limiting housing supply.
The long-term societal impact of this seems truly profound.
It is. The U.S. housing deficit currently stands at a staggering 4.7 million units. And for those who do own, the median net worth of a homeowner is an astounding 43 times that of a renter.
43 times. That really highlights a rapidly widening wealth gap.
It really does. First-time buyers dropped to a record low of 24% in 2024, down from 32% just a year prior. And their median age has climbed significantly to 38, up from 28 back in 1991.
So this shift really compels us to ask a fundamental question. Is homeownership still the universally aspirational goal it once was?
That's exactly the question. Yeah. Some experts are now suggesting that for many, particularly younger generations like Gen Z, renting might actually offer a more pragmatic and, well, beneficial path.
How so?
Well, it provides greater mobility, often comes with lower upfront costs, and allows individuals to invest in experiences or other assets rather than being solely tied down by home equity.
Yeah.
It signifies a significant reevaluation of a deeply ingrained societal aspiration.
In adding another layer of complexity here, while domestic buyers are increasingly priced out, foreign buyers are stepping in.
That's right. Sales of U.S. real estate to non-U.S. citizens increased a significant 33% to $56 billion in the year through March. That's the first such increase in 8 years.
And this is happening precisely as domestic buyers are sidelined.
Exactly. By high interest rates and broader economic jitters. Notably, 44% of these sales were to non-U.S. residents, often securing properties for vacation homes, family use, or just pure investment.
Any specific examples?
Yeah, consider Scotty Mortimer, an Australian investor. He acquired 5 properties in Illinois and Missouri, specifically targeting the Midwest for its, quote, fantastic cash flow.
Interesting. And the political climate. Trump's trade war and immigration crackdown.
It did create a chilling effect for some, like Canadian real estate investor Virginia Marcolin. But overall, foreign interest in U.S. real estate is showing remarkable resilience. It demonstrates this persistent belief in its long-term stability and value, regardless of the immediate political climate.
So, with all these swirling factors, what does this actually mean for you if you're contemplating buying a home? Isn't it now a good time? What does Zillow say?
Well, Orfa Devunga, a senior economist at Zillow, offers some nuanced advice. Zillow forecasts a modest 0.8% drop in its home value index by year-end 2025. That would mark the first annual decline since 2011.
A decline, but a small one.
Very small. However, Devunga advises those who can afford it not to try and time the market, as interest rates are unlikely to recede significantly in the near future.
Are there any potential opportunities for buyers right now?
He highlights several. Yeah. Including muted competition, increased inventory, with 27% of July listings showing price cuts, and generally more leverage for buyers in certain areas.
That varies regionally.
Very much so. It's truly a story of regional differences. Sellers markets continue to dominate in areas with limited new construction, like the Northeast and the West Coast. Conversely, buyers markets, characterized by price declines, are emerging in regions with high construction activity like Texas and Florida.
But even there, it's not straightforward.
No, because even in those areas, you have to factor in increasingly high insurance costs, which are becoming a significant impediment to affordability.
And for sellers.
Many are sitting on near record home equity from the pandemic boom, which allows them to cut prices without being forced into a sale. However, a cooling labor market may reduce overall residential mobility, meaning fewer people are moving unless absolutely necessary.
Okay, transitioning from housing to a rather unconventional economic barometer. Let's consider the humble cardboard box.
Yes, the cardboard box indicator.
Declining corrugated cardboard box sales are unexpectedly serving as a non-traditional economic indicator, signaling a potential correction in retail demand across a broad spectrum of industries.
This is an incredibly astute proxy for economic health, really, because the demand for boxes touches virtually every industry, from flat-screen TVs to packaged food. And the fact that boxes are typically ordered in near real time makes their sales a quick, reliable indicator of current buying and manufacturing activity.
So what are the numbers showing?
U.S. box shipments fell to their lowest second quarter reading since 2015. Major players like International Paper saw a 5% drop, and Smurfit Westrock experienced a 4.5% slide in North American volumes.
And why is this happening now?
Well, a key factor here is how the mixed messaging and uncertainty surrounding tariffs are causing companies to delay stocking up on bulky packaging. Compounding this, weak U.S. consumer sentiment is also playing a significant role. UPS CEO Carol Tomei observed that the small package market was, quote, unfavorably impacted.
What's the long-term outlook for the box industry, then?
It's cautiously optimistic. There are hopes for a pickup if the tariff situation eventually stabilizes. There's also potential for a domestic manufacturing renaissance to boost demand.
But that's offset by other factors.
Potentially. It would need to counteract reduced imports, which often require repackaging, and a potential drop in American food exports. What's also notable is that several mills are already closing due to high operating costs and aging facilities. Like International Paper's Louisiana mill, which was once the seventh biggest employer in its parish. That has significant impacts on local economies.
Okay, let's shift gears now and look at some surprising turns in the world of business and innovation, starting with a significant bust in the electric pickup truck market.
Yeah, this one is fascinating. Legacy automakers like Ford and GM, along with EV startups such as Tesla and Rivian, seem to have drastically overestimated consumer interest in electric pickup trucks.
How bad is it?
Sales actually fell 4% in the first half of 2025, totaling a mere 35,000 units. Meanwhile, their gasoline-powered counterparts sold a staggering 1.6 million units during the same period.
1.6 million versus 35,000. That's a huge difference.
It really is. And this situation compels us to re-examine what truck buyers truly prioritize. A primary reason for this bust seems to be genuine utility concerns.
Like range and hauling capacity?
Exactly. Truck owners use their vehicles for serious hauling, and electric vehicle range and capacity are often simply insufficient for these demanding tasks. Jim Weber, an Ohio mulch company owner, found that his Ford F-150 Lightning demo delivered far less than its rated 320 miles when loaded with typical cargo.
That's a real-world problem.
Definitely. Then there's the price point. A Rivian R1T, for example, can easily run over $800 a month, placing it out of reach for many.
So what's the industry doing?
Well, Ford, learning from this, is planning a more affordable midsize electric pickup, targeting around $30,000 by 2027 to try and reignite sales. But beyond the practicalities, there's this strong emotional and even political connection to traditional trucks.
The sound, the feel.
Right. Many owners value the throaty growl of a V8 engine and view EV trucks as a political statement in our divided nation. Randy Higley, a dealership owner in Cowtown, Texas, described it candidly. He says, quite pointedly, that it's simply not cool to drive an electric truck in Cowtown.
So the industry's response reflects this miscalculation.
Absolutely. Ford's F-150 Lightning sales plummeted 26% in Q2. GM is actively retooling plants that were initially slated for electric truck production because of underperforming sales.
Yeah.
Automakers now face a significant marketing challenge to convincingly demonstrate the true capabilities and practical value of these electric pickups, especially to a skeptical and demanding truck-buying demographic.
Okay, moving to a different consumer sector now. Welch's fruit snacks are undergoing a significant transformation, embracing a dye-free future.
Yes. Piam Brands Inc., the company behind these widely popular fruit snacks, is eliminating synthetic food dyes like Red 40 and Blue 1 from its entire product lineup by early next year. And this move is a direct response to a powerful and growing consumer demand for more natural ingredients.
What did that involve? It can't be easy reformulating something like that.
No, the meticulous process involved is quite striking. It required extensive collaboration with suppliers to address the pH sensitivity of natural dyes, which are derived from fruit and vegetable juices.
Why is pH sensitivity an issue?
The crucial challenge was preventing the snacks from turning an unappetizing brown over their one-year shelf life, which is a common issue with natural colorings. While these natural dyes are, quote, a lot more expensive, PMM has managed to absorb these costs without directly increasing prices for consumers.
Which is good for consumers.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And this initiative clearly reflects a broader, decisive trend in the food industry. It signals a shift toward responding to consumer preferences for cleaner labels and ingredients perceived as more natural.
Let's turn our attention now to the financial sector and explore Klarna's ambitious journey from a niche buy now, pay later, or BNPL service,
right,
to aiming to become a full service bank.
Yeah.
After surviving that massive valuation drop from $45.6 billion in 2021 down to $6.7 billion in 2022 due to economic shifts and rising interest rates.
A huge drop.
Klarna is now profitable once more and actively preparing for an IPO, and their sights are firmly set on evolving into a comprehensive financial institution.
Klarna's strategic execution in its growth phase has been remarkably effective. They've secured pivotal partnerships with major players like Airbnb, DoorDash, Expedia, and Uber.
Big names.
And crucially, they solidified a deal with Walmart to become its exclusive provider of short-term loans. The United States has now emerged as Klarna's largest market, fueling much of its recent resurgence.
How's their financial health looking now? Delinquency rates.
That's a notable aspect. Delinquency rates fell to an impressive 0.88% in Q2, which is lower than many of its rivals. They've also been adept at offloading risk, recently striking a deal with Elliott Investment Management to purchase approximately $30 billion or $40 billion in debt.
But they face stiff competition.
Oh, yeah. Formidable competition from other digital-first banks, such as Nubank in Brazil and Revolut in the UK. Revolut, interestingly, despite having fewer users than Klarna, boasts a more substantial deposit and loan portfolio.
And what's next for Klarna? What are they planning to offer?
Looking ahead, they recently broadened their U.S. offerings to include mobile phone plans. Stock trading and remittance payments are next on the roadmap. Their ultimate goal seems to be becoming an all-encompassing digital financial assistant.
Helping people manage their money.
Exactly. Empowering customers to save money and time, making them, as Klarna puts it, less worried about your finances. It's a bold strategic move to expand their ecosystem well beyond simple payment solutions.
So what does all this changing landscape mean for a classic American brand like J.Crew? Libby Waddle, she's in her third year as CEO since J.Crew emerged from bankruptcy in 2020.
Right.
She's spearheading a significant turnaround, meticulously focused on restoring both the brand's intrinsic quality and its cultural cachet.
Her strategy for revival seems both intentional and really rooted in the brand's heritage. She's prioritized bringing back that thick wool twill quality and reintroducing beloved classic items like the Shetland sweater.
Is that working?
Apparently so. It's now a major bestseller. And to truly reignite the brand style, she's brought in elevated designers. Olympia Gaillot for women's wear and kids, and Brendan Babenzian as men's creative director.
And the results.
This focused approach is showing early success. Sales are approaching $3 billion, which is up from $2.5 billion pre-bankruptcy. And average retail revenue per piece climbed an impressive 50% in Q1 2025.
Wow. What about tariffs impacting prices?
Waddle remains tight-lipped about the precise impact of tariffs on prices, but she firmly promises no dilution of the brand.
And the whole Jay Screwed thing. The financial past.
Yeah, interestingly, despite those past financial woes that led to the unflattering Wall Street term J Screwed and the subsequent J Crew blockers and other deals, she's denied rumors of an acquisition. She's confidently asserting that the energy is back and the company successfully refinanced a loan.
Okay, diving into a truly unique and booming industry now. Let's talk about the billion-dollar doodle dog phenomenon.
The doodles, golden doodles, labradoodle, and a whole host of other poodle hybrids have just exploded into this cutthroat billion-dollar industry. They're meticulously engineered to be the ultimate pets for everyone, you know, perfectly suited for urban dwellers, growing families, and even banks, those dual-income, no-kids couples.
What's the tension point here? I hear breeders aren't happy about something.
Yeah, a fascinating aspect here is the deep frustration among breeders over the American Kennel Club's persistent refusal to recognize doodles as true breeds. This significantly constrains their ability to command premium pricing.
How frustrated are they?
Some breeders have even gone so far as to compare the AKC's blood purity stance to, well, historical controversial concepts, which really speaks to the intensity of their feelings.
Is there a scientific angle to this?
There is. A push is underway. Veterinarian Robert Westra predicts that golden doodles are mere generations away from becoming reliably replicable in terms of their size, coat, and temperament. If this genetic consistency can be achieved, it would pave the way for AKC recognition.
And the growth has just been massive.
Nothing short of explosive since their origins in the late 90s. Demand caught on like wildfire. Initially, genetic testing companies even refused to test doodles, but eventually relented due to overwhelming consumer demand. And tellingly, insurance policies on doodles surged a remarkable 160% between 2013 and 2021.
160%. So It makes you wonder, are we reaching peak doodles?
That's the question. Amy Lane, one of the original breeders, now spends $5,000 a month on SEO advertising just to sell dogs that used to simply sell themselves. That signals potential market saturation.
Yet the trend continues.
It does. It continues to evolve, with new breeds like Pomapoos emerging, and people are going to extraordinary lengths to acquire them, like flying from Chicago to JFK for an 8-week-old pup.
And this intense demand has even spawned an underground market.
It has. With one breeder clandestinely studying out poodles to doodle breeders using a burner phone and non-disclosure agreements, this secrecy is reportedly due to the brutal purebred community who, as the breeder describes, will destroy your breeding program and dox you if they discover such cross-breeding activities.
Wow. Okay, shifting gears to corporate philosophy and social impact. Let's explore Patagonia's unfinished revolution in capitalism. Yvon Chouinard, the iconic founder, he famously sought to fundamentally rewrite how big corporations operate, giving away his $3 billion company in 2022 to a trust and nonprofit structure designed to funnel all future earnings directly to environmental causes.
Chouinard's vision is profoundly iconoclastic, isn't it? Deeply rooted in his upbringing and this consistent set of values like funding childcare for employees or even suing the Trump administration to protect national monuments.
How was he able to do that?
This radical approach was largely feasible because of his sole ownership of the company until 2022. That liberated him from the conventional pressures and demands of shareholders.
But his vision often clashed with corporate norms.
Frequently. For example, Walmart once sought his advice but ultimately balked at his rather straightforward suggestion to simply stop selling sugary drinks.
Just stop selling them.
Just stop. And this incident perfectly highlights the, quote, gulf between a company like Patagonia and those with far more potential to drive systemic changes.
So while Patagonia proved a profitable model for responsible business, its legacy has limitations.
Definitely. Because most other companies simply operate by an entirely different set of rules. His broader vision, as described in the sources, is unconventional and completely pie in the sky in the context of current politics. It suggests that his impact as a truly systemic agent of change is still very much unfolding.
Okay, from the highly structured world of corporate ethics to the famously chaotic BlackRock desert, We're now looking at Burning Man's unexpected cash crunch.
Yeah, the Burning Man Project, the nonprofit behind the iconic Anarchic Desert Festival, is facing a severe financial crisis. In 2024, for the first time in a decade, tickets failed to sell out.
Really? Didn't sell out?
Didn't sell out, leading to a substantial $20 million revenue shortfall, which, according to the organizers, is putting everything at risk.
That presents a fascinating paradox, doesn't it? For a festival that, at its heart, holds anti-capitalist principles.
It really does. CEO Marion Goodell openly acknowledges the necessity to succeed as a business, but simultaneously expresses her reluctance to look at Burning Man as a product.
Worried about compromising its character.
Exactly. Her concern is that financial survival could compromise the festival's unique character and its radically inclusive principles. They're grappling with significant growing pains and escalating costs, too. Government oversight, for example, has swelled their permit requirements from a single page to a formidable 174 pages.
174 pages.
Yeah. Coupled with increasing responsibilities like managing heavy equipment and even an airport, this means growth hasn't brought economies of scale. They essentially need more people to manage more people.
The festival's ticket strategy and its outcomes also reveal some interesting demographic shifts, I understand.
They do. Standard tickets were $575 in 2024, with some reduced cost options available. Filtered tickets, which could go up to $2,500, were introduced to help bridge revenue gaps, but even these weren't enough.
And the demographic stats?
Quite telling. The share of burners earning less than $50,000 annually fell sharply from 47% in 2015 to 27% in 2024, while those earning $150,000 plus jumped from 11% to a significant 29% in the same period.
So fewer lower-income attendees, more higher income.
That's the trend, and this data points to a growing reluctance among the ultra-wealthy burners to contribute proportionally to the festival's operational needs.
Even though they spend a lot on their own camps.
Right. Two-thirds of the $60 million raised since 2014 came from just five individuals. While ultra-wealthy burners, people like Sergey Brin and Elon Musk, might spend millions on elaborate, lavish camps, they are notably less inclined to fund essential public goods, like the portable toilets, which cost $3.2 million last year.
What's their advice?
Their advice to leadership often leans towards austerity rather than increased donations.
So what's the plan for the future?
New ticket tiers, explicitly ranging from $225 to $3,000, are now being openly marketed to subsidize lower-income attendees. Furthermore, the organization's leadership is planning for succession, acknowledging this period as a major test for Goodell's ability to guide the festival through these turbulent financial waters.
Okay, moving on to geopolitics now. Let's delve into what's been characterized as Trump's America and everybody else foreign policy. This approach is fundamentally defined by an us versus them outlook, right?
That seems to be the core of it, where traditional allies and adversaries are not viewed as fundamentally different. Instead, relationships are largely transactional, prioritizing, as he often puts it, really good deals right now.
How does this policy manifest in specific scenarios? Let's take Brazil as an example.
Okay, Brazil is a prime example. Trump brazenly threatened 50% tariffs on all Brazilian products in an attempt to compel their government to drop charges against his friend, Jair Bolsonaro.
Did it work?
No. When defied, he selectively implemented tariffs on certain items, like coffee and beef, notably exempting Brazil's major exports such as airplanes and oil.
What was the justification?
The White House publicly justified this by claiming Bolsonaro was being unfairly treated by political opponents and accusing Brazil of insidious attacks on free elections and grave injustices against Americans.
And the outcome.
Fascinatingly, Trump's demands deeply infuriated Brazilians, paradoxically boosting President Lula's approval ratings. Meanwhile, Bolsonaro himself was deemed a flight risk and placed under house arrest with an ankle bracelet.
Wow. So it underscores the unpredictable nature.
And often counterproductive nature of such a transactional foreign policy. Absolutely.
We're also observing significant impacts on traditional alliances under this approach.
We are. Trump has, for instance, successfully pushed NATO allies to increase their defense spending. However, the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, agreed to 15% tariffs on most EU exports to the US, a rate higher than many expected.
Which caused anger within the EU.
Considerable internal anger, yes. And renewed discussions within the EU about diversifying trade to new markets in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. In the Middle East, this policy prioritizes cultivating ties with authoritarian-leaning regimes, often at the expense of established democratic alliances.
What are the experts saying about this shift?
Zooming out, experts like Matthew Kronig of the Atlantic Council and Max Bergman at CSIS both highlight a clear and deliberate shift away from shared values toward purely transactional deals. Rachel Tausenfrond of the German Council on Foreign Relations further emphasizes Trump's apparent lack of belief in long-term nation-to-nation relationships.
Has this approach led to blunders?
It has led to some notable blunders, yes, like his obsession with Greenland or the suggestion of Canada becoming the 51st state. And he's arguably oversold his influence with Putin regarding Ukraine.
But also unpredictable actions.
Yes, he's also taken unpredictable actions, such as dropping bombs on Iran. He's notably struggled with the urgency of the Gaza famine. And securing a long-term trade agreement with China remains an elusive goal. All of which illustrates the often contradictory and challenging nature of this America and everybody else foreign policy.
Now let's shift our focus to immigration and border policy, examining some contrasting national approaches. We'll start with Germany's remarkable Syrian immigrant success story.
Yeah, this is quite something. Two-thirds of Syrian asylum seekers who arrived in Germany a decade ago now have jobs. Their employment levels are just 9 percentage points below the national average.
That sounds like a profound economic success story.
It really is. Martin Werding, an economist, estimates that each newcomer contributes an impressive $7,100, or about $8,300, to the state budget annually. That totals $3 billion a year.
How are they achieving that?
Primarily by adding young taxpayers to the workforce and helping to spread out pension expenses, which is critically important for Germany given its aging population and the need for 400,000 new people a year for its workforce.
But the path wasn't without its challenges.
No, definitely not. Initially, a policy bar on working meant Germany missed out on valuable skills. Placing refugees in rural areas where housing was cheaper often complicated integration due to higher local unemployment rates. Government support for essential language instruction is also under increasing pressure.
And public attitudes.
They have hardened. Anti-immigration sentiment is being actively exploited by far-right populist parties like the AfD. Despite these hurdles, though, there are truly inspiring success stories.
Like who?
Like Ryan Alshabal, a Syrian refugee who was elected mayor of Ostalheim in 2023, and Shahama Botris, who fled Damascus and now works for a Christian organization in Berlin.
Okay, now in stark contrast, let's look at the evolving situation with U.S. Border Patrol's warrantless arrests and the ongoing legal challenges.
Right. A judge in California's Kern County issued a significant injunction against Border Patrol's warrantless arrests. That ruling temporarily halted such detentions from April 29th to June 21st.
And this legal strategy is being seen as a potential nationwide model.
Yes, championed by the ACLU and the United Farm Workers, the UFW, the tactics specifically halted included what were termed roving patrols.
What did those involve?
They snatched people based on what's been described as blue-collar profiling, targeting individuals seen up before a certain hour near agricultural work sites, or simply dressed as farm workers or landscapers.
What was the legal basis for the injunction?
It hinges on the fact that Border Patrol's authority for warrantless arrests is generally limited to within 100 miles of the border. Judge Jennifer Thurston found agents likely violated Fourth Amendment rights, stating quite directly, quote, "You can't just walk up to people with brown skin and say, 'Give me your papers.'"
How has the Trump administration responded?
Forcefully. They signed a budget that allocates $5 billion for new checkpoints and another $4 billion for new agents. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem further extended Sector Chief Gregory Bovino's authority to include parts of California's Central District, notably encompassing Los Angeles.
So the legal battles continue.
Yes. A similar injunction was imposed in Los Angeles in July, though the Department of Homeland Security is currently appealing it to the Supreme Court.
This also brings us to a particularly troubling development, the rise of private ICE camps.
Yeah, this is concerning. Obscure disaster response companies with absolutely no prior experience in detention are now positioning themselves to profit immensely from Trump's mass deportation plans.
How much money are we talking about?
A staggering $1.6 billion in combined federal and state money was awarded this summer alone for new tent detention camps.
The speed and scale sound worrying. Any examples?
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis quickly moved hundreds of individuals into a state-run camp in the Everglades, promptly dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. Concurrently, construction is well underway on an army base in El Paso for what will become the country's largest immigration detention facility.
What's the core controversy here?
It's that these soft-sided facilities are legally intended for short-term processing, ideally a maximum of 72 hours. However, typical ICE detention periods are much longer, necessitating far higher standards for basic human needs, things like bathroom ratios and beds.
Are they meeting those standards?
Lawyers are already alleging that the Everglades camp is failing to meet these essential guidelines. These camps, while more expensive per bed than existing jails, are valued for the speed at which they can be deployed.
And new companies are getting involved?
Yes. ICE has issued preliminary contracts to 41 companies, over 20 of which are small firms completely new to detention work, shortlisting them for further expansion. This rapid expansion aligns notably with Project 2025, a conservative policy playbook, which explicitly suggested using tents for quickly adding detention capacity.
Okay, moving to the Middle East now. We observe a remarkable financial resilience amidst escalating conflict.
It's quite striking. Despite events as severe as an Iran missile barrage on a U.S. airbase in Qatar, the region's low tax regimes and a staggering $5 trillion in sovereign and family wealth continue to attract significant global investment. It illustrates these powerful mega forces spreading wealth through the region.
So global investment continues despite the risks.
It does. BlackRock, for example, secured a $5 billion investment pledge from Riyadh. Brookfield Asset Management invested $2 billion in Dubai-based GEMS education. KKR & Co. appointed General David Petraeus to chair its Middle East franchise. Even wealthy Russians post-Ukraine invasion have bought significant real estate in Dubai.
Some investors even see opportunity in the turbulence.
Some do, yes. Ken Marlis, for instance, suggests that hostilities could paradoxically lead to negotiations and ultimately unlock Iran's labor force and vast oil reserves. Blackstone CEO Steven Schwarzman also consistently views the Gulf as a premier investment destination. It highlights a resilient and sometimes counterintuitive investor perspective that sees long-term value despite immediate instability.
And in a particularly striking example of this regional resilience, Israel's financial markets are actually booming despite 22 months of brutal multi-front war.
It's incredible, isn't it? The Tel Aviv Stock Exchange's benchmark index climbed an impressive 21.3% in the first half of 2025, significantly outperforming most global markets. And that was driven primarily by foreign investors. The shekel also strengthened a notable 9% against the dollar.
How are markets interpreting the conflict?
Well, it seems investors interpreted events like the Hezbollah pager explosions, the killing of its leader, the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria, and the joint U.S.-Israel attack on Iran's nuclear program as indicators of Israel's technological ingenuity and a significant shift in regional power dynamics.
But substantial challenges remain.
Oh, absolutely. Prime Minister Netanyahu's government faces acute internal strife. The ultra-Orthodox draft exemption, ongoing judicial opposition, a concerning brain drain. The nation's debt-to-GDP ratio has surged to 70%.
So sustaining the rally requires more than military success.
Much more. It requires translating military achievements into tangible regional alliances, which appears unlikely given Netanyahu's current stance on Gaza and a Palestinian state. On a different note, though, the conflict itself has paradoxically served as an incubator for defense tech innovation and spawned new startups emerging from connections forged during Israeli reserve service.
Okay, stepping into a truly chilling development now, let's talk about Russia's escalating hybrid warfare, or active measures.
Yes, this has intensified sharply after the Ukraine invasion. These tactics encompass everything from sabotage and disinformation to covert attacks. And now, the targeting of Armin Papperger, CEO of the German defense company Rheinmetall, marks a terrifying new frontier in this undeclared war.
How serious was the plot against him?
Deadly serious. U.S. intelligence specifically warned Germany of an active Russian plot to kill him. It was identified as the most advanced of several plans targeting European defense executives. An arson attack on his garden house in Hermannsburg in April 2024 appeared to be a clear act of intimidation, maybe a warning shot.
And Papperger has been central to European rearmament.
Aggressively so. He's spearheaded European rearmament efforts, strategically acquiring competitors, and dramatically ramping up production. Rheinmetall stock has surged an astounding 18-fold since the war began, solidifying its position as Europe's most valuable defense company at 81 billion.
He even made deals based on handshakes.
He did. He greenlit massive investments like an 8.5 billion artillery ammunition contract based on what were essentially handshake deals with the German government. It underscores both his commitment and the incredibly high stakes involved.
What kind of tactics is Russia using?
They're increasingly sophisticated and alarming, reportedly hiring local criminals for acts of sabotage, a warehouse fire in the UK, a mall fire in Poland, a Molotov cocktail attack in Latvia. They've even tested incendiary devices cleverly disguised within DHL shipments.
And they're recruiting within Germany.
Actively, from the large Russian diaspora in Germany, exploiting a lapse in German counterintelligence operations that spanned from the 1990s to 2017.
This must pose a profound security concern for Europe.
Immense. We've witnessed numerous espionage scandals in Germany, arrests of a BND intelligence officer, a German army officer passing sensitive info to Russia. Russia's GRU unit 29155 has even been sanctioned by the EU specifically for its assassination and destabilization activities.
What's the outlook for Rheinmetall and Papriger?
Production expansion at Rheinmetall is currently behind schedule, but Papriger aims for $20 billion in annual sales by 2027 and plans to divest civilian businesses to focus entirely on defense. He has, understandably, significantly ramped up his personal security measures, stating, "I feel safe," but the palpable threat from Russia's hybrid warfare remains a constant concern.
Moving to a truly bizarre but deeply concerning development now, North Korea's remote worker scheme, the so-called laptop farmers.
Yeah, this is wild. North Korea is ingeniously using this remote worker scheme to fund its government, deploying agents to work as contract programmers, graphic designers, IT professionals for hundreds of unsuspecting U.S. companies.
Startups to Fortune 500s.
Exactly. From small startups all the way up to Fortune 500 giants, the operation is incredibly complex and deeply unsettling.
Tell us about the facilitator, Michelle Chapman.
Right. Michelle Chapman, a coding bootcamp graduate, inadvertently became a laptop farmer. She hosted laptops for North Korean agents and facilitated payments for them, typically between $5,000 and $11,000 a month. She initially believed she was just a cool intermediary for legitimate foreign engineers.
How did the North Koreans operate? Their modus operandi?
Quite sophisticated. They use stolen identities of 60 real U.S. citizens, creating incredibly convincing backstories through online background check services like CenturyLink, which Chapman herself accessed. They openly recruit on major job boards like Freelancer.com and Upwork for roles such as U.S.-based remote IT hardware custodian, often paying a mere $50 for the setup.
And they hold multiple jobs. Job stacking.
Yes, job stacking is common, with superstar IT workers reportedly earning between $600,000 and $800,000 annually for the regime.
And Chapman felt exploited.
Her personal experience highlights the exploitation and coercion involved. She felt chained to the computers, was forced to delay care for her ailing mother due to demands, and was pressured into depositing paper checks into her account and then transferring money via services like Payoneer and PayPal.
It wasn't just about fundraising, though.
No. Beyond fundraising, these workers also exfiltrate sensitive data, particularly from crypto companies, and in some instances, even engage in extortion.
How are companies and law enforcement responding?
Detection and response are proving quite challenging. Most companies, upon discovering these infiltrations, quietly fire the workers, fearing embarrassment and spooking investors. However, law enforcement agencies like the FBI and cybersecurity firms like Palo Alto Networks are actively tracking these networks.
Where do these networks operate from?
All over. Locations as diverse as Dandong, China, Russia, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, and various countries in Africa, sometimes even from embassies.
What happened to Chapman?
Unfortunately, Michelle Chapman was indicted on charges including wire fraud, bank fraud, money laundering, and unlawful employment of aliens. She's facing federal prison, while the DPRK agents she dealt with are unlikely to ever be apprehended.
So what are the implications for, well, for you, the listener?
This situation underscores a profound vulnerability in the remote work landscape. It implies that U.S. companies need to implement far more demanding due diligence processes, maybe asking prospective hires to verify their location via laptop camera during interviews. This whole saga highlights the deep interconnectedness of geopolitics with seemingly mundane IT jobs. Even tech giants like OpenAI have banned suspected North Korean accounts from using ChatGPT for recruiting purposes.
So what does this all mean for our daily digital lives? The social media trend machine is spitting out weirder and weirder results, apparently.
It really is. With trends that are disorienting even for younger generations, they often lack traditional backstories or any clear relevance to real life.
Give us some examples of this nonsense.
Well, consider recent examples like Labubu, Dubai Chocolate, Sunny Angel, Benson Boone, Matcha Lattes, or the Crumble Cookie Craze. Many of these phenomena lack any discernible origin story or logical explanation for their sudden virality.
Like Labubu. What's the story there?
Labubu, these miniature plush monsters from a Chinese toy company, gained widespread popularity in the U.S. primarily because K-pop star Lisa from Blackpink loves them and posts them on Instagram. That's basically it.
A stark departure from past trends.
Absolutely. past trends, think Cabbage Patch Kids, Beanie Babies, even the recent Stanley Cups, typically had clear reasons for their virality. Maybe identity, scarcity, utility, or targeted influencer marketing. The current wave of trends instead operates on the core logic of the social internet. They are highly stimulating, strange, cute, delicious-looking, outrageous, or simply confusing enough to grab attention.
And algorithmic stimulation is central to this.
Absolutely central. Algorithms are designed to propel content based on engagement, even if that engagement is merely pausing for a few seconds to watch something perplexing. This stimulation-first pitch effectively short-circuits adult defenses against impulse. Things like critical discernment, self-restraint, patience.
So it makes us more impulsive.
In essence, it makes us a little bit more childish, reacting emotionally and impulsively to whatever is placed directly in front of us.
But physical reality still matters.
What's truly intriguing, despite this overwhelming digital pull, is that the most popular trends still ultimately involve material things that require people to go out into the real world to interact with them. Whether it's buying a specific snack or collecting a toy, these digital trends still culminate in a physical interaction.
So the struggle is reconciling the online and physical world.
Exactly, which are no longer separate. Navigating that complex interplay as best we can.
Okay, in a related vein concerning information control, let's explore the tech world's growing podcast obsession and its role in narrative shaping.
Right. Venture capitalists, VCs, have actively created this burgeoning media ecosystem. Podcasts, newsletters, streaming shows, all strategically designed to set the narrative within the tech industry.
Influencing insiders and the public.
Both, yes. This is a clear case of VCs transforming into influential media moguls. Many prominent VC firms now operate their own media outlets. Shows like 20VC, Sorcery, TBPN function as powerful platforms for VC musings, sometimes even delving into seemingly mundane topics like the insufficient weights found in hotel gyms.
When did this boom start?
It really took off in early 2020 during the initial phases of COVID-19, spearheaded by podcasts like All In, known for its insidery discussions and techno-utopian right-wing political leanings, alongside the rise of the Clubhouse app.
And Mark Andreessen explicitly wanted to control the narrative.
He did. Andreessen, an early Clubhouse investor, explicitly stated his desire for traditional media not to control the narrative. In response, his firm, Andreessen Horowitz, even launched its own publication, Future.
And these successful shows translate into real money and influence.
Directly. Harry Stebbings, host of 20VC, successfully raised a $400 million venture fund. Similarly, Eric Torenberg's podcast-heavy media company, Turpentine, was acquired by Andreessen Horowitz, where he subsequently became a partner.
So, the implication for you, the listener.
Zooming out, it means that the stories, analyses, and perspectives you encounter about the tech industry are increasingly shaped by the very people who are funding it, often with a very specific agenda. This kind of narrative seizure means you're not always receiving an unbiased, comprehensive view, making critical evaluation of your information sources more important than ever.
Okay, Lufren Pak, a persistent societal issue that profoundly impacts careers. The child penalty on women's earnings.
Yes. Research consistently demonstrates that women's earnings rarely, if ever, fully recover after they have children. They face significant career penalties that men typically do not experience.
Where does this come from? What's the mid-30s time crunch?
It's often rooted in that mid-30s time crunch, which is heavily influenced by the soaring expectations of 21st century parenting. Both parents, but particularly mothers, are expected to invest intensely in their children's development. Think about the pressure to speak 10,000 words a day to a toddler or meticulously limit screen time.
And men don't face the same career penalties.
Typically, no, not for their increased time devoted to childcare. Women consistently do. Global disparities are quite revealing, too. Parenthood reduces women's employment rates by a significant 25% in the U.S. compared to just 11% in Namibia.
That seems counterintuitive. Why the difference?
It ironically reflects the privilege of women in developed countries to choose time with children. Yet countries like Sweden and Norway provide generous parental leave policies and robust government support systems specifically designed to help mothers remain actively employed.
And it's clear the squeeze lasts well beyond early infancy. Parental leave isn't a complete solution.
No, it's not. Employers frequently tout flexible schedules, but data indicates that predictability is far more valuable to mothers. For instance, some studies show women are willing to forego up to 40% of their wages just to avoid unpredictable schedules, highlighting the intense trade-offs they face.
So this compels us to ask about systemic solutions beyond individual choices.
Exactly. Companies could significantly improve their retention of women by actively strengthening work-life boundaries and by designating on-call backups for after-hours work. These measures provide the predictability and support that mothers truly value, ensuring that work-life balance isn't merely a platitude, but a tangible reality.
Okay, diving into a truly unsettling portrait of political power and youth now. The story of a young DOGE coder dismantling institutions.
Yes, Luke Ferreter, a promising young coder and Thiel Fellow, joined the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, a Trump administration initiative. Despite its official mission of modernization, DOGE primarily focused on what sources describe as destruction and tearing down to the floorboards.
And using inexperienced young coders to do it.
Surprisingly inexperienced, yes. Ferreter's background makes this narrative all the more stark. He was a student at the University of Nebraska Rake School, an honors program renowned for values like quality, integrity, empathy. He'd won the Vesuvius Challenge Grand Prize, $700, was a Thiel Fellow, admired Elon Musk.
What was the DOGE hiring process like? The vibe check?
Unusual, reportedly, including these vibe checks where candidates were directly asked, did you vote for Kamala Harris? Are you comfortable working for Donald Trump? Many were rejected for having the wrong vibes. And the standard requirements of the U.S. Digital Service College degree, 5 years experience, were completely bypassed for DOGE hires.
So the official mission was modernization, but unofficially.
Unofficially, as a current government employee stated, it was quite simply destruction. Young, inexperienced foot soldiers were delegated significant and often unchecked power.
What were Ferreter's specific actions and their impact?
Considerable. He was reportedly involved in curtailing HIV/AIDS prevention programs, withdrawing grants for public health, cultural initiatives if they contain trigger words like gender, trans, diversity, race, women, justice, equality, climate. He gained access to sensitive data, was reportedly involved in firing thousands of civil servants, and contributed to the Defend the Spend website.
The consequences and backlash must have been intense.
Intense and personal. Ferreter subsequently went dark on social media, was publicly labeled a traitor and fascist, his father even receiving online threats. Sahil Lavinja, another former DOGE member, was reportedly fired for merely praising the Department of Veterans Affairs efficiency, highlighting the administration's zero-tolerance approach. Ferreter himself has been referenced in at least 23 lawsuits.
It raises concerns about wisdom and experience, doesn't it?
Deep concerns. As former classmates expressed, about 22 and 23-year-olds being tasked with dismantling core government foundations, lacking, as one put it, wisdom from having burned your fingers a number of times and the essential skill of influencing people in power. A stark illustration.
Okay, now let's explore global living, lifestyle, and culture. Beginning with the fascinating evolution of urban housing solutions, particularly Medellin's transformation into a digital nomad hub.
Right. Medellin, once tragically notorious for cartel violence, is now experiencing this boom in viviendas turísticas, tourist homes. These are purpose-built housing options that skillfully combine elements of boutique hotels, co-living spaces, and studio apartments, specifically targeting that burgeoning number of digital nomads.
What are these places like? What features do they offer?
They're meticulously tailored to this new demographic, typically offering large private rooms with kitchenettes, robust fast internet, design-intensive common spaces, and often include planned activities, all starting at around $50 a night. Architects prioritize natural airflow, abundant plants, cooling materials reflecting a thoughtful, climate-conscious, urbanist sensibility.
Didn't this initially cause problems with rent spikes and tourism issues?
It did. Initially, the conversion of local apartments into Airbnbs caused significant rent spikes and exacerbated issues like sex and drug tourism. However, new regulations now wisely limit short-term rentals in traditional residential buildings. This pushes these purpose-built developments into less gentrifying neighborhoods.
And it appeals beyond just foreign nomads.
Yes. What's notable is that the appeal extends beyond just foreign nomads, who make up less than 10% of visitors. These spaces also attract relocated employees and newly divorced locals, demonstrating that, quote, what appeals to nomads appeals to a lot of people.
Okay, in another rapidly developing urban center, Dubai's extraordinary housing boom is paradoxically stoking fears of another market crash.
It's a huge boom, record-breaking housing activity. 51,000 home sales in Q2 2025, total transactions reaching $73 billion through June. This surge is fueled by a massive influx of foreign professionals and wealthy investors, Russians, crypto millionaires, affluent Indians.
Is there cautious optimism this time compared to previous crashes?
There's a noticeable sense of it, yes. Lenders are maintaining stringent rules, like capping mortgage limits at 80% of a home's value. Developers are required to pay for land upfront, all of which suggests a more maturing and less speculative market. Less than 5% of buyers are reselling within 12 months, a stark difference from the 25% seen during the 2008 boom.
But fears of another crash persist. Why?
Yes, they do. Nearly 250,000 homes are on track for completion in the next few years. That represents a substantial 30% increase in supply, leading to genuine worries about a repeat of the 2008 and 2014 downturns. New developers are aggressively entering the market, with surging land prices squeezing profit margins.
And luxury is a key driver.
Very much so. New developments like Marriott's 66-floor tower offer lavish infinity pools, panoramic views. Joseph Kleindienst's ambitious $6 billion Heart of Europe project even aims to recreate sections of European cities.
Shifting our focus to Europe now, we see another innovative approach to urban living: co-housing.
Yes. Cluster flats and other co-housing arrangements designed for 8, 10, 12, or even more residents are rapidly gaining popularity, particularly in cities like Zurich, offering both cheaper rents and a strong sense of community.
What's the model for these spaces?
Quite innovative. Residents typically enjoy private bedrooms and bathrooms, but share expansive living rooms, kitchens, and dining areas. Many co-ops incorporate additional communal spaces like rooftop gardens, workshops, guest accommodations, and frequently bar cars, actively encouraging shared mobility solutions.
Why is this trend accelerating now?
For several compelling reasons. It simultaneously addresses both urban loneliness and the pressing housing crunch. Architects like Andreas Hofer are reporting a significant surge in requests for cluster flats in new residential developments.
How does this differ from the U.S. market?
A notable distinction is evident. Adoption is slower in America because homes are primarily viewed as stores of wealth, and public backing for housing is typically reserved solely for low-income residents. Whereas in Europe, these co-ops are increasingly attracting even millionaires.
New York City is also making strides in urban housing solutions through ambitious office-to-residential conversions.
That's right. The city is leaning heavily into adaptive reuse projects, transforming vacant office space into much-needed housing stock. A prime example is the $340 million makeover of a former archdiocese headquarters, being converted into 420 luxury apartments with a crucial 105 designated as affordable.
What kind of features do these conversions offer?
An array of impressive features. Fully equipped gyms, dedicated co-working facilities, high-end spas offering amenities like cold plunges, salt rooms, vitamin C showers.
Is this a new trend in NYC?
Not entirely new. Historically, roughly half of Lower Manhattan's housing stock has originated from conversions over the past three decades, a process that significantly accelerated after both 9/11 and the financial crisis.
What makes conversions appealing? Cost and speed.
Exactly. A key appeal is their cost and speed, estimated to be 50% cheaper and twice as fast as ground-up development, primarily because they bypass site raising and extensive foundation work. Tax incentives also play a substantial role, reducing property taxes significantly.
But not all buildings are suitable.
No, vacant properties with smaller floor plates and excellent light and airflow are much easier to convert. While undoubtedly a step in the right direction, it's widely acknowledged that this strategy is not a panacea for affordability problems.
Finally, turning to Mumbai, we observe a fascinating and paradoxical trend: high-rise amenities paired with shrinking living spaces.
It's quite the paradox. In India's bustling financial capital, luxury apartment buildings are incorporating more and more lavish amenities, pools, gyms, extensive greenery, while the actual private living spaces for residents are steadily shrinking, driven by growing wealth and intense market demand.
The demand for luxury in Mumbai is soaring.
Absolutely soaring. Homebuyers now expect state-of-the-art fitness centers, exclusive clubhouses, park-like gardens, grand lobbies. Developers are locked in a competition to outdo each other with extravagant offerings, like the world's highest residential sky gym, infinity pools, hydro gyms.
And this is happening against the backdrop of India's booming economy.
Precisely. India's fastest-growing economy means a rapid surge in wealth. The number of Indians with over $30 million is projected to increase significantly by 2028. Mumbai's average residential price per square foot climbs significantly in just 1 year.
What's the impact on the middle class?
Profound. Luxury properties now constitute nearly half of all housing sales, while homes priced under 5 million rupees drop sharply from 54% in 2018 to 22% in 2025. This forces middle-income workers to live increasingly further from their workplaces, leading to longer commute times and ultimately a reduction in their overall living standards.
Okay, now for a bit of a palate cleanser. Let's briefly touch on the global culture calendar, highlighting some selected events for this fall. Just a few significant moments in art, theater, music.
Sounds good. A quick tour. In the world of art, the Met Museum in NYC is hosting Man Ray, When Objects Dream. Lots of iconic rayographs and other pieces offering a fresh look at the surrealist master.
And in London.
London's Serpentine North will showcase Danielle Brathwaite Shirley's interactive video game, The Delusion, really pushing boundaries in digital art.
Theater highlights.
A much-anticipated reunion. Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter together again in Waiting for Godot at the Hudson Theater in NYC. That's an iconic pairing for classic
music.
Thomas Gugace makes his Berlin Philharmonic debut, conducting also Sprech Zarathustra, and Gustavo Dudamel kicks off his farewell season with the LA Phil, promising a poignant series of performances. Hayato Sumino also makes his Carnegie Hall debut.
Movies to watch out for.
Keep an eye out for A Savage Art. A documentary on the incisive political cartoonist Pat Oliphant feels particularly relevant today. And maybe a surprise, Dwayne The Rock Johnson takes on the role of MMA fighter Mark Kerr in The Smashing Machine, a dramatic turn. Also, Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, with Jeremy Allen White as young Bruce.
How about books?
Gene Pressman's They All Came to Barney's offers a fascinating look into fashion retail history. Ian McEwan has a new one, What We Can Know. Brandon Taylor's Minor Black Figures. And Anthony Hopkins' memoir, We Did Okay, Kid.
Streaming recommendations.
The Paper, a journalistic mockumentary on Peacock from The Office creators. Sterling Harjo's noir, The Lowdown on FX Hulu. Ryan Murphy's All's Fair about all female divorce lawyers on Hulu. And of course, Netflix's House of Guinness is expected to capture many viewers.
And finally, dance.
Crystal Pite's Figures in Extinction will have its UK premiere by the Netherlands Dance Theatre, a powerful piece exploring environmental themes. Hubbard Street Dance Chicago also has its fall series, just a glimpse into a rich cultural landscape.
Great overview. Now let's do a bit of a deeper dive into the entertainment industry, beginning with Netflix's upcoming House of Guinness and our collective persistent succession obsession.
Right. Netflix's new 8-part drama, set in the late 19th century, follows the dramatic lives of Benjamin Guinness's 4 children as they fiercely grapple for control of the vast family beer empire after his death.
It definitely taps into that fascination with family succession dramas, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A narrative thread stretching from ancient Greek tragedies, Shakespeare's royal sagas, all the way to our modern obsession with shows like Succession.
And there are companion books, too.
Yes, 2 nonfiction books are being released to complement the series. Guinness, A Family Succession, by Arthur Edward Guinness, the 4th Earl of Iva, and Adrian Tinniswood's The Houses of Guinness, a glossy compendium exploring the family's magnificent mansions. It offers a deep dive into both the fictionalized drama and the rich historical tapestry.
Okay, next up we have Swiped, a biopic aiming to restore some girl boss glory with a focus on Bumble founder Whitney Wolfhard.
Yes, starring Lily James. This film celebrates Wolfhard's entrepreneurial journey, attempting to reclaim that girl boss narrative after it became somewhat synonymous with corporatized feminism and problematic workplace dynamics.
A crucial element is that Wolfhard couldn't participate directly.
Yeah.
Due to an NDA.
Exactly. She couldn't participate due to her 2014 settlement with Tinder, which Lily James quite pointedly describes as a weaponized non-disclosure agreement.
So what story does the film tell?
It traces Wolfhard's journey from her role as a Tinder co-founder through a difficult breakup with Justin Mateen, who reportedly became abusive, to her visionary founding of Bumble. Her mission was clear: create an app prioritizing women's needs, a strategy that ultimately led to Bumble reaching an impressive $20 billion valuation.
And the timing is interesting, with her returning as CEO.
Yes, the timing is noteworthy, as Wolfhard reassumed the role of CEO in March 2025. While the film promises to explore aspects of character flaws, it is fundamentally a celebration of her success and a powerful attempt to reframe and reaffirm the girl boss legacy in a more positive light.
Rounding out our entertainment deep dives, Brian Cox, back on our radar.
Indeed. Widely known for his commanding role in Succession, takes on the surprising character of Adam Smith's ghost in a new British play titled Make It Happen. Written by James Graham, this drama vividly dramatizes the very real collapse of the Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS, in 2008.
Using fantastical elements, Adam Smith's ghost.
Yes, Graham made some bold, dramatic choices to convey the immense scale of the bailout. opting for fantastical elements and deliberately moving beyond solely blaming high-profile individuals like former RBS CEO Fred Goodwin, often known as Fred the Shred.
So the play broadens the blame.
It does, implicating leaders at the Bank of England and elected officials, suggesting the crisis was also a profound reflection of unregulated capitalism itself. Addie Smith's ghost serves as this unique narrative device, wandering through the play, attempting to make sense of the enduring legacy of his economic ideas and how they've been interpreted and perhaps weaponized in the modern financial world.
Switching gears now for a fun peek into the personal lives of the powerful, let's explore CEOs' comfort TV, the shows they watch on repeat.
Always intriguing to see what captures their attention off the clock. Mark Metrick of Sachs Global Enterprises, for example, turns to 30 Rock, specifically for Alec Baldwin's humor.
Who else?
Kristen Dalton from TripAdvisor enjoys Person of Interest for its tech-forward, problem-solving narratives and adrenaline rush. Burt Jacobs, CEO of Life is Good, describes himself as a geek for nature documentaries and loves Netflix's Life on Our Planet, hyper-realistic visuals, Morgan Freeman's voice.
Anywhere.
Michael Wolff, CEO of Resort Pass, finds solace in the West Wing, appreciating its teamwork towards a shared goal, not its politics. And Christian Clark of A Burj Resorts Collection can't get enough of Landman, feeling it captures the Texas spirit, especially since some scenes were filmed at their Fort Worth property. A revealing glimpse.
Okay, let's unpack this next segment, looking at some interesting trends in lifestyle, starting with the wine industry's young guns of Sonoma County.
Right. Jesse Katz of Aperture Cellars, Baron Ziegler of Marine Layer Wine, and Chef Kyle Conanen of Single Fred. They're achieving remarkable success in an otherwise struggling wine industry through a blend of risk-taking and innovative technique.
What are some of their achievements?
Quite impressive. Conanen's Single Thread restaurant has earned 3 Michelin stars. Ziegler's Banshee Wines is on track to become a million-case brand, a significant feat. And Katz's Aperture Wines will soon be poured on United Airlines Polaris, with his collage wine receiving an astonishing 5 perfect 100-point scores.
What's distinctive about their approach? Outsiders.
Exactly. They operate as outsiders in an industry often dominated by established families, claiming, quote, no limitations from our fathers or grandfathers, which allows for significant innovation and a focus on personal connections and community. They even aged ponzu in a marine layer barrel.
But they still face industry challenges.
Oh, yes. They're not immune, including an overall decline in winery numbers, direct-to-consumer sales falling by 10%, and the ever-present escalating threat of climate change.
Okay. From the vineyards of Sonoma, let's journey to Robert De Niro's Barbuda Paradise.
Yes, the acclaimed actor is personally developing the Nogu Beach Inn on the small Caribbean island of Barbuda, an island he himself describes as a paradise that is notably difficult to reach, typically requiring a yacht, private jet, or helicopter.
This is a massive personal investment for him.
Huge, reportedly totaling hundreds of millions of dollars. The project is designed to be ultra luxurious, a spa, oceanfront infinity pool, a Nobu restaurant moving into the main building, exquisite bungalows starting at $2,500 a night.
Villas too.
Yes, private villas starting at $12 million and empty lots available for $7 million plus. De Niro and his partners also plan to establish homes there.
Has the project faced setbacks? Criticism?
Significant setbacks, yes. From Hurricane Irma's devastation to the impact of COVID-19. It has also drawn criticism from some Barbudans who label it destructive and exploitative.
And De Niro is personally involved in the details.
Deeply. He's reportedly sweating the small stuff. From the precise shade of Ipewood for the shade structures to the design of the closet doors. Guided by his own uncompromising aesthetic. If it pleases me, I'm sure it will please other people.
Now for a more unsettling global trend. Let's talk about the global crime of burglary tourists.
Right. Chilean lanzas internacionales, or international thieves, traveling to the U.S. and other countries, often disguised as tourists, with the express purpose of committing high-end burglaries, particularly targeting the homes of professional athletes.
The Joe Burrow heist is a chilling example.
It really is.
Yeah.
4 Chilean suspects allegedly stole $300,000 in jewelry, including a distinctive JB9 diamond necklace and a Cartier watch, from the NFL quarterback's home, reportedly celebrating afterward in a safe house near Disney World.
And this was part of a broader spree.
Allegedly, yes. They hit 6 pro athletes' homes in late 2024. Including Bobby Portis Jr. for $1.48 million, Jim Morant for $1 million, and even high-profile targets like Travis Kelce and Patrick Mahomes.
What makes this so alarming are their sophisticated tactics.
Incredibly sophisticated. Meticulously monitoring game schedules, targeting homes near open expanses like woods or golf courses, using pepper spray on guard dogs, walkie-talkies, $3,000 Wi-Fi jamming devices to disable security systems.
And they only target specific areas, items.
Yes, meticulously ransacking only master bedrooms, focusing exclusively on high-value items, jewels, watches, handbags, sunglasses, cash, and extensively scouting to ensure the homes were unoccupied.
What do we know about the suspects' backgrounds?
Often revealed as Chilean citizens from Santiago, frequently from tough, high-crime neighborhoods like La Legua, when arrested, they often claim to be mere tourists seeing the snow.
And the Chilean criminal culture around this.
As described in the sources, thievery has a place of honor in the Chilean underworld. Operating under the maxim, the opportunity makes the thief. They generally disavow violence and are known to learn quickly, perfecting techniques in University of Crime prison sessions.
How did they gain entry to the U.S. so easily?
A 2014 U.S. visa waiver, which allowed Chileans to enter the U.S. with minimal vetting for 90 days, effectively enabled the tour. Travel agencies often finance these trips, charging a steep 25% interest.
How do they get the stolen goods back? Smuggling and money laundering.
Tactics have evolved. Traditionally, thieves simply wore loot home. But now, with tightened Chilean laws, they fence goods in the U.S. and wire cash home in chunks under $10,000, often using neighbors to build a clan of Confederates.
Is law enforcement having any success against this?
Fortunately, yes. Robust intelligence sharing between the FBI and Chile's PDI, their investigative police, has led to significant arrests and confiscation of stolen goods, including a $1.3 million raid in Santiago and even the recovery of Keanu Reeves' stolen Rolex.
Okay, that was an incredible journey through the September issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. We've seen how powerful global forces like tariffs and complex geopolitical conflicts are reshaping everything from the unexpected cost of your dorm room essentials
right down to the basics
to the surprising resilience of entire financial markets.
And we've explored fascinating shifts within various industries, from the unexpected bust of electric pickup trucks forcing a reevaluation of consumer needs to Klarna's bold ambition to evolve from a payment service into a comprehensive full-service bank. It's undeniably clear that business models and consumer behaviors are constantly in flux, often transforming in very surprising and impactful ways.
Indeed. From the reevaluation of the girl boss narrative in that new biopic to the intricate billion-dollar world of doodle dogs and even the dark underbelly of remote work potentially funding rogue states.
This deep dive shows us just how interconnected and dynamic our world truly is.
Mm.
Every headline, every emerging trend, every piece of data holds a story and carries a tangible impact on us. Absolutely. The landscape of housing, for instance, is dramatically transforming globally, with everything from innovative co-housing models in Europe to large-scale office conversions in New York City and vibrant digital nomad hubs emerging as both solutions and complex challenges. It serves as a powerful reminder that fundamental human needs, like shelter and community, are being reimagined and redefined in real time across the globe.
So what does all this mean for you as you navigate your own life, your career, your curious interests? Consider this. In a world where venture capitalists are increasingly setting media narratives and social media feeds are spitting out an endless stream of bewildering trends, how much of the information you consume is truly designed to inform you?
Yeah, versus how much is subtly, perhaps even unconsciously, shaping your perceptions and desires.
Yeah.
And this prompts an important line of thought. In an era defined by such rapid change and overwhelming information overload, what personal strategies can you cultivate, you know, to truly discern what is genuinely important, to connect the dots across seemingly disparate topics, and ultimately to remain not just well-informed, but critically engaged with the complex world around you?
A truly thought-provoking question to chew on. Oh. Thank you for joining us in this deep dive into Bloomberg Business Week for September 2025. We look forward to our next exploration with you.